Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Did you see that tweet about the Beatles logo? The one started by a guy called Eddie Robson.
Yep.
Fantastic story. You know, basically, they were the first group, it appears, possibly, we shall discuss this, to have a logo in the way that the Beatles were first pretty much doing everything. Epstein and Ringo had gone to Shaftesbury Avenue in 1963 to get him a new drum kit. And he'd seen this Ludwig kit, which was 238 quid. But Epstein, kind of being Epstein and thinking, well, this is the Beatles, and being a wheeler dealer and a horse trader, said he wasn't going to pay for it. So wanted it for free. And the shop said, OK, you can have it free, but you've got to paint the Ludwig, have the Ludwig logo painted on the bass drum. And then they agreed that they'd have the Beatles logo put on there too, or the Beatles name. And the guy who did it for £5 invented effectively the Beatles logo. You know, the word with the word beat with the big T.
The big T.
And that was the only time you ever saw it, which was on the drum kit. None of those albums ever had the logo on it.
No, you see, I did. If you'd said to them at the time, Do you have a logo? I think they would have said no. They just wouldn't have thought of it at all. That's the interesting thing, that there was a time when it wasn't thought of at all. And actually, the only two instances in which your attention is drawn to that logo is in its place on the drum head, which is at the beginning of both Let It Be, the original film, which starts with a shot of a close-up of the drum, and then it was revealed to be Mal Evans carrying it into the studio. And it's also the opening shot of Get Back all those years later.
That's right.
So it only really exists in those places. Now, the other interesting thing is that when words were written on drums, they tended to be the name of the drummer.
Yeah, like
rather
Dave
than
Clark.
The group. Right.
Ginger Baker.
And
that
was a jazz tradition, wasn't it?
Yeah,
you know, the Buddy Rich or whatever. Yeah. You are watching Buddy Rich with a band. You know, that's him. Please admire him. You know, so it was kind of odd, half-hearted thing for the Beatles to do this. And it wasn't actually used on any of their records until the Past Masters series, those two, they were both CDs, weren't they?
Yeah.
Appeared in whenever that would be, the end of the 80s or something. You know,
well,
they had two singles.
It. Apple Corps didn't trademark it till the very early 90s, I think.
Oh, there you go.
So that's how much they cared about the idea of a Beatles logo.
But then there was, you know, the discussion ensued online that, you know, I was asking, were there any groups before the Beatles who had a logo? And people were saying, well, were there any groups before the Beatles? Which is an interesting point, you know. And I went looking, and the Shadows never had one, as far as I could see.
Yeah.
Somebody suggested to me that the Ventures had one. The Ventures, I mean, an American instrumental group of the very early 60s. They were a very big deal. And eventually they appeared to develop a thing that looked like a motor car logo with a big V, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think they did that rather later. The earliest example I could find, and I'd be interested to see if anybody can come up with anything that challenges this or that predates this. The first album by the Yardbirds, which is Five Live Yardbirds, which comes out in 1963, has their name rendered as a logo.
It does.
It looks like crow's feet, doesn't it? It's a very self-conscious
story with that. It was a guy called Hamish Grimes.
It's a really interesting story, this is. There's a guy called Hamish Grimes who worked with Giorgio Gomelsky, who was the original Yardbirds manager and was a bit of a scenester, and is actually the person who can be heard introducing them on Five Live Yardbirds, you know, member name by name. You know, he's the guy who says on lead guitar, Eric Slowhand Clapton, which was the first time that had gone into the public domain and so forth. And that is Hamish Grimes. Hamish Grahams was also the person who invented that kind of font for a way of doing the Yardbirds logo. And it was used on most of their LPs.
They use it all
certainly the American ones. So that, you know, the odd changes in the UK. Roger the Engineer doesn't have it on in the UK. But anyway, most of them, and certainly most of them in America, have that logo. So I'm saying that's the earliest rock band logo, unless anybody can tell me different. But the other interesting tangent, Hamish Grahams is a person who ought to have an entire documentary made about him, because the other thing that in rooting around trying to find out about Hamish Grahams, I never realized this, that the famous Clapton is God graffiti, you know, that appeared allegedly.
Clapton thinks it was him.
Clapton thinks it was Hamish Grahams. And that would make complete sense, you know, because he clearly was the kind of person who did something like that.
Yeah.
And so he rendered, you know, the Clapton is God on some corrugated iron fence, and then went and photographed it and said, look, oh, there it is. It's out there in the public domain. And ever since then, people have been quoting that line ever since. And all it was a Banksy in 1963.
Genius piece of original promotion.
Absolute genius. So that's Hamish Grahams. He's no longer with us, sadly. But I think he was the inventor of that kind of thing. But the other person who played a huge part in all this is Jack Holtzman of Elektra Records, a man who started Elektra Records. Jack Holtzman is still with us, as far as I know. The great patron of kind of folk rock, and, you know, the man who started out doing Judy Collins and Tom Paxton and so forth, and then eventually, you know, moved to the West Coast, and it was Love and the Doors and all that kind of thing. He was the person who very early on, and I think the groups who are most obviously beneficiaries or victims of this treatment, depending on how you want to look at it, were Love and the Doors.
Yeah.
Both of whom are still represented all those years later by those really distinctive logos. And he was the guy who said to the company's art director, Bill Harvey, who was a hugely important person in Elektra, that he wanted every group to have a logo.
Where would he have got that? I mean, that's amazing, isn't it?
Well, because Bill Harvey was
label when he was at college, didn't he?
Jack Holtzman, fascinating character. I interviewed him once on, and we did a podcast interview with him years ago. Really interesting guy, and he's a person who's rightly celebrated for his, you know, his knack with the musicians and being associated with all kinds of really interesting music that proved to be commercially successful. But I think the thing that he really deserves celebrating for is he invented rock marketing. He really did. The whole idea,
those billboard campaigns that he did for the Doors.
But more than that, it was just the whole the way of packaging an album, of making an LP record seem more attractive and more valuable than it probably was by the way it was done. He did all that. He was the person who said, I want it to look like this. And the way it looks is going to be pretty much as important as the way it sounds. So he was the person to do this. But he also realized that I was looking at Mick Houghton's really good book about Elektra, becoming Elektra. And I was reminded that one of the reasons he did this is that the logo would remain the property of the record company.
So they couldn't leave
the label.
Because they did, they would have no logo. Brilliant, wasn't it?
But it just shows you how the name, A, the name, and B, the rendition of the name, are hugely important things, you know. So he did it enormously successfully with Love and the Doors. But even if you look at loads of other acts, I mean, there's a group called Clear Light on Elektra. They had a logo, you know. Clearly, Bill Harvey was set to work on every one of these as they came along. And then later on, it got taken up by, well, I don't know, who, you know, Led Zeppelin and people like that. You know, they.
But not till their fourth, or was it Houses of the Holy was the first time they had a logo, I think.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, okay. So it wasn't that quick, actually.
No. And of course, nowadays, no group would dream of going out undressed without a logo.
I know. If you just Google something like Blur albums, they all come up. You see all the sleeves, because every single one of those has got the logo on it.
Yeah.
It's an automatic thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's just branding thinking, isn't it?
There are logos that I can't visualize that name without seeing it as the logo. Best example, I think, is Motorhead. Motorhead's logo. You just, in your head, you can just see that written the way the logo is, with the umlaut and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
There are certain ones that are absolutely...
Van Halen.
Van Halen. Kiss, another one of things.
Yes, Kiss, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're probably...
Ramones, possibly.
They're probably kids who can draw that stuff on school exercise books. Although, interestingly enough, I had a strange memory yesterday while thinking about all this stuff. I never had a group, but I used to fantasize about having a group when I was like 13.
Did you have a name for them?
I had a name.
Oh, God, do I know this? I don't know if I do. No. Come on.
It's terrible, though.
David Hepworth experience. Has it got your name in it?
No.
No. This is brilliant. I want to know. Come on. Tell me the name of the group, and I'll be able to work out, presumably, what year.
No. Well, I don't think I've told. No, and I used to just improvise this on school exercise books, you know, during particularly boring geography lessons, you know, and they were called the Rapids. The Rapids. And I used to, and somehow I drew that so that it kind of looked like the Rapids, as in you know, running water.
That's,
you know,
fantastic. The Rapids.
And so, without knowing it, in 1963 or something, I invented the rock logo. If only I'd invented the band. You know?
That is fantastic. The Rapids. You can date that precisely, kind of mental group. Did you have a little in your head? Did you have a little dance routine you used to do? I'm sure you did. That's fantastic.
So anyway, I'm saying that the Yardbirds pioneered the rock band logo. And if you've got an earlier example, we want to hear about it.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So great news. The whole of Frasier is available on whatever the Channel 4 app is called, More 4, is it, or whatever. Anyway, it's
and
all
you
there.
Watch the whole thing.
I haven't
rewatched.
I've started at the beginning and I worked my way through it, and of course enjoying it greatly. The best episode, I have to say, so far, and I've probably watched about three series, is the one where Niles hires what can only be described as a kind of a thug called Jerome Belasco to sort out his wife's parking ticket or something. And then they slowly realize they're in the debt of this rather sinister, genuinely sinister kind of Sopranos character. That's been the best one so far. I'm very much looking forward to my other favorites, which always used to be the one with the two of them. And I think it just features Frasier and Niles, where they're planning a dinner party, which never actually happens. Do you remember this?
I do. Go on.
And they're allowed to veto each other's choices of potential guests, you know, by blackballing them and so forth.
Yeah.
And then trying to get the right caterer, trying to get the right evening and all these kind of things. It's just absolutely brilliantly done. I mean, the thing that strikes me about Frasier is just so much how it so much resembles a kind of French farce, you know, a kind of 19th century.
Do you remember
it's all entrances and exits and people disappearing in the
disappearing, hiding in the kitchen
or whatever.
Absolutely.
It's just brilliantly
done. Do you remember
the
one where Niles, I think it lasts about 5 or 6 minutes where he's ironing a shirt and manages to set the flat on
yes,
fire.
He does.
And it finishes out with him spraying the flat with a fire extinguisher. This is amazing piece of physical comedy.
Absolutely.
Another great one where he and his dad, Martin, pretend to be a gay couple. I can't remember. Do you remember that one where I think they're trying to get rid of some suit?
Go to the opera, yes.
Yes. Oh, God. It's
that's one to come. The other one is the one where they have to pretend that, Fraser's going out with a girl whose mother arrives and she's Jewish. And so she would prefer it if he pretended that he was Jewish. And so he then has to get Marty to pretend that he's Jewish. He says, how do I do that? It's just turn every statement into a question.
Very good.
Whatever anybody says to you, you just repeat it with a question mark at the end. Oh, God, it's so good.
Nearly every sitcom is based on one simple foundation, isn't it? And in the case of Frasier, I think it's no more complicated that the fact that Niles and Frasier are these kind of pretentious arses, aren't they? And that the other four main characters are really down to earth.
Absolutely.
And Roz and Daphne and Bulldog are all these really down to earth, ordinary, socially integratable, functioning human beings. All that humor comes from the clash between the two.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. Anyway, the odd little strange experience I've had while watching it, because I'm watching it on the app.
Yeah, yeah.
It serves you the same ads all the time. You know, so I've seen certain ads hundreds and hundreds of times. And one of them is the trail for the new movie Licorice Pizza. Have you seen this trail?
No.
And it's just very quick cut kind of romance type, you know, interactions. But the piece of music used for it is David Bowie's Life on Mars. And because it's abbreviated even more in the trail, all you really hear of it is just the opening piano chord of Rick Wakeman's.
You know? Yeah.
And then you hear bits of the song, and you sit and watch the trail, and you think, this trail would not exist without that tune. It just simply doesn't work without that tune. And it reminds you, you know, I think this week, again, the catalogue of David Bowie, wasn't it, was sold to investors or to whoever for a premium, as we've remarked on with various other acts. And this was a reminder about why people do it, because Life on Mars, which was it ever really a huge hit? I think maybe it was once or whatever. It wasn't the first time it came out. But the point is that the Life on Mars, this song from a long, long time ago, just has this power to kind of evoke something, which makes it really powerful when used in a film in the 21st century, all these years later. And it's just an amazing reflection on the power of old pop music to do that, and that nothing new does that to anything like that, that level of intensity.
It couldn't have that depth of emotional connection, could it?
It doesn't. It also makes you think, once again, how much did Rick Wakeman get paid for that?
Yeah, session rate.
It wasn't enough.
25 quid or something.
I mean, God's sake, I mean, this applies to everybody, but it particularly applies to David Bowie, doesn't it? Go back through the career, you know, Rick Wakeman, Mick Ronson, Nile Rodgers, you know, Robert Fripp, all these absolutely key collaborators, you know, who provided the musical fingerprint of loads and loads of these, loads and loads of these tunes, and probably don't participate in royalties or the massive, you know, obviously they don't participate in the payday of selling on a catalogue, you know, to the publisher or whatever.
Based all part, those, yes, based part on Walk on the Wild Side. That was the Herbie Flowers. That was the big court case, wasn't it? Because he was saying, this is the signature of this song. This made this song.
I don't know. Did he actually get anywhere with that?
There was a court case. I can't remember what the result was.
I don't know. Because Robert Fripp, I know there was some kind of action recently over Robert Fripp on Heroes, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Because, you know, they will say without Robert Fripp on Heroes, it barely exists at all, you know. And so
who was the jazz piano player that Bowie got him? Was it Mike Garson?
Mike Garson, yeah.
Yeah, because there was the documentary last night, being his birthday, Bowie's birthday, on the BBC, in which you got an idea of just how significant his playing was. It was amazing. Completely altered and lifted and changed those songs.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think hugely reliant on these kind of musicians all the way through, as are loads of successful musicians, you know. But Rick Wakeman if he's caught the trail for licorice pizza as many times as I have,
he'll think these guys
are thinking, my God. I recommend you go and see the trail. It's absolutely astonishing.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Well, we've both been following the story that various British ministers have backed demands for the national anthem to be played at the end of BBC, it being the Jubilee year, etc., Queen's Jubilee year, at the end of BBC television broadcasting. Actually, obviously, it is played on Radio 4 every night, you know. Yeah. And various people have said...
Is it really?
Yeah, it is, yeah. Radio 4 still play it.
Why, every night? I didn't know that.
Go on. And various people have suggested, Danny Baker tweeted a very funny thing. He thinks it should be Soul Bossa Nova by Quincy Jones, which, of course, is the music that you can immediately visualise Austin Powers leaping about.
All right.
Bobby's on bicycles and red pillar boxes and stuff. You know. But it did make me think that there should be a more contemporary British national anthem rather than the national anthem. And I thought, I think... I was Kaiser Bill's Batman.
First of all, you know, I've always responded favourably to Billy Connolly's suggestion many years ago that the British national anthem was a bit of a drag. It was just slow, whereas most anthems are not slow. And his suggestion was that the theme for the Archers ought to be the UK national anthem, which I always think there's a lot to be said for that. You know, it's a damn good tune. It's it's peppy. Makes you feel better. But anyway, go on.
I think At the Sign of the Swinging Cymbal by Brian Fay and his orchestra. Do you remember
It's Pick of the Pops. That's
Walk cool. Don't Run, the John Barry version. It would be fantastic, I think. John Barry 7. Man of Mystery by the Shadows. I tell you what would be good, and this is none more British, is Cry for a Shadow by the Beatles. Do you remember that instrumental they recorded?
Right, okay.
The only John Lennon, George Harrison comedy. San Jose, obviously, by Chicken Shack. And I think Jazz, Delicious, Hot, Disgusting, Cold by the Bonzo Dog Doodle Man would be brilliant.
Well, I have the answer. I have the answer to what should be the new UK, you know, kind of tune to go to sleep to in the evening, because it's British. It's a lovely tune. It defies the passing of the years. It is The Shadows and Wonderful Land.
Oh, right. I know it. Yes.
Wouldn't that be lovely?
That would be really good.
It's a lovely tune to drift off to sleep to. And, it's British, for God's sake.
It's British. As is surely Telstar by the Tornado.
That's
another possibility.
Yeah.
Chiquita by the Dave Clark Five. That's a good
thing. The main theme from Get Carter by Roy Budd. The piano theme there. There's also there's a very good John Barry tune from his record String Beat, which he made in 1962 or whatever, called There's Life in the Old Boy Yet. That's a good tune.
Yeah.
So there's plenty there, but I'm sure, you know, people have got other suggestions.
Nutlocker, Beeble and the Stingers.
Yes, but that's, you know, it was Tchaikovsky via America, isn't it?
No, maybe it's not British enough.
Maybe it's not British at all.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Any other business? And we're joined by Alex Gold. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
Keith Adsley wants to know, chaps, do we have a go-to track to test new headphones, turntables, or other new sound equipment?
And was it Keith that suggested Jack of Speed?
He suggested Jack of Speed.
That's a genius suggestion. Do you know that track?
I know it, but
from
I haven't.
The Two Against Nature album by Steely Dan. It's fantastic. The brass, the separation, you can hear every instrument so clearly. It's just a terrific piece of production. That's a good one.
The one I was told by somebody years ago in a hi-fi shop, and I always thought it was a really good idea, is Walk on the Wild Side by Lou Reed.
Yes.
Because you know it so well. But it's also recorded in quite an old-fashioned way, you know. So there's a drama about it. There's a separation there about it.
And if you hear it clear enough, you can hear the fact it's got a string bass and an electric bass.
And that's why Herbie Flowers got paid twice. He got £230, didn't he, for two instruments.
£230, wow.
£230.
Lucky boy.
Yes, compared to whereas Lou Reed got, £30 million.
Apparently, a lot of live sound engineers use, what Steely Dan is it? It's one of the latest Steely Dan albums, Night...
Well, that's probably what we're talking about. Against Nature? No.
It wasn't that one. But anyway, they use a specific Steely Dan album because apparently it's mastered so perfectly. It's sonically, according to the science of sonics, the most perfect record you could possibly hope for to test the balance of speakers. The science of sonics. Yeah.
That's a Steely Dan album still waiting to come out.
Yeah.
So Gareth wants remarks upon the role of the sampler album in making the unsuccessful well-known. Case in point, Nick Drake sold very few albums, but everyone knew who he was and a couple of his songs, if they were on among the many bought island samplers that charted, which is fair. It's absolutely true.
You know, that's where I discovered Nick Drake.
Absolutely.
And King Crimson. I'd never heard of them.
Yeah, yeah. And going and outside Ireland, going to CBS, everybody in the early 70s knew Statesboro Blues by Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
Nobody had a Taj Mahal record, but they'd all got the Rock Machine Turns You On, or whichever those records were that was on. He also says, supplementary question, what about the role played by the cover of You Can All Join In in setting sartorial standards for a generation of young men? And I happen to have it in front of me. And, you know, if you're watching this, if you're a patron supporter, you'd be watching this, wouldn't you, Alex?
You would indeed.
And you'd be able to see the fact that I'm holding up the copy of You Can All Join In.
And we all look that. We all have one of those ex-army greatcoats. I'm sorry. And the bobble hats.
This picture, taken in the Hyde Park, in the morning after a kind of all-night island do just near Hyde Park. And so that was the only chance to get all these people together after they just returned from down the M1 from playing Mothers in Birmingham.
And half the people in the picture don't appear on the cover because, of course, the photographer couldn't kind of arrange it into a kind of the right shape, could he? There's a load of people missing.
I think it might be an Aubrey Powell who took this picture. I think it might be. No, it's really unarranged. I mean, the only woman... Is she the only woman? Yeah, Sandy Denny. He's almost edged out of the frame entirely there, over on the right. And, you can just about see members of Jethro Tull gurning at the back of there, you know. But, yes, it was a hugely influential thing in
the most prominent person on that sleeve is somebody who didn't appear on the record. Am I right? Ian Anderson.
The guy with the glasses. Yes, he was supposed to be on it, wasn't he? And then wasn't.
Because Ian Anderson, Jethro Tull, so we've got two Ian Andersons on Island Records. I think it was kind of barred, wasn't it? They just decided they wouldn't put the Ian Anderson.
Well, Ian Anderson was the guy who ended up running Folk Roots magazine, wasn't he? Probably still does it to this day. David Cowan has a very interesting point. During the now infamous hidden mic in the cafe sequence in Get Back, we had two men in their 20s, working class men at that, I'm not sure about that, but anyway, having quite a long conversation and not using the F word once. Would this have been normal for 1969? Or do you think they would have been aware of the microphone? I think it would have been more normal than you probably think, actually. People did not swear as freely in 1969. As they subsequently did. Do you agree with that, Mark?
Completely. And also, just going back to the microphone, clearly they didn't know the microphone was there or they wouldn't have had that conversation in the first place.
No.
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's... I'm not sure if people don't swear more now, actually.
Oh, they do. I really do.
Because it's become completely... You know, you watch the Graham Norton show or something and someone said fuck within 2 seconds of the thing starting. So it's completely part of common parlance.
Well, it's a performance now, I think, swearing. Whereas my memory of swearing when I was a kind of teenager was that if you got a holiday job or whatever, you worked on the Christmas post, or, you know, I worked in a kind of packing department of a mail order business when I was about 17 or whatever. And you were suddenly surrounded by people who really did swear all the time. And you're aware that was different from your normal life. It wouldn't have been like that at school. Not that people didn't swear at school, but they didn't swear habitually in the same way. And whereas now you get the thing that didn't happen then and happens now is really educated people swear all the time.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to make themselves appear not to be too different from other people. You know what I mean?
It's but also
makes you connected.
Swearing's a lot more prevalent in music, isn't it? Actually, the other day I was watching something on Instagram, and Olivia Rodrigo, the cutesy 18-year-old pop star of the moment, dropped an F-bomb in her latest hit. You know?
Yeah.
That's the kind of world we live in.
Which then, of course, it will be, the F-bomb will be on the record, because the weird thing is, if it's played on Radio 1, it won't be there, will it?
Yeah.
There'll be that strange
magical edit
out. You know, exactly. Which I always think makes listening to Radio 1 utterly intolerable, because half of the music's gone. Well, they've taken out.
Yeah,
you think, why put it in the first place if you're going to have to take it out? You know, the interesting debate. Andy Phoenix says, are CDs the new vinyl? How long before the music industry
that
starts?
That can't be possible. The magic of the album and the gatefold sleeve cannot be replicated by some creaky little plastic device with a broken hinge and a little booklet that gets worn away when you stick it in behind those lugs.
Actually,
I don't know. Is it the same?
No, it's never gonna. It's never going to be a romantic item. Undoubtedly,
it's a functional item, isn't it?
But it's a functional item, and there is a place for it as a functional item.
Yeah,
I do think it will return as a functional item. Go
on. I wandered into HMB in Swinging Redditch the other day. And I tell you, like, there was as much vinyl, if not more, than there were CDs in the store.
Oh, there would be.
Yeah, obviously, yeah.
Well, do you know the reason for that? The reason for that is you charge 25 quid for them, you know, so it's worth, you know, it's worthwhile them, you know, displaying them and so forth. But I do think CD will come back, because I think there has to be a basic physical carrier for those who like a basic physical carrier, and it's the least destructible of those physical carriers. And so, you know,
it doesn't take up much space,
doesn't take up a huge amount of space, you know. And in the end, if you really like something, you want something that you hold in your hand, you know, in the end. Richard Oswald says, albums and books that you've bought by accident, forgetting you already have a copy. He said he did this the other day with one of my books.
Oh, that's nice.
Richard, which I would like to heartily applaud this practice.
Yes,
I think more people who think they've got one of my books should go out and buy another one, just in case they haven't, you know.
But isn't that just the emotional response, like Danny Kelly with his 17 copies of Marquee Moon by Television? It's just that emotional response of seeing the thing in the shop, and just, you'll be just programmed, you're hardwired to buy it, aren't you?
The great thing about Danny buying his copies of Marquee Moon was that he bought them during the heyday of CD, when people were just letting go of their vinyl copies. You know, see, every charity shop he went in, there would be vinyl copies of Marquee Moon as far as the eye could see. And of course, now it would be entirely the other way around, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
You probably find you can buy CD copies of that in every charity shop. Yeah.
You're listening to The Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
At this point, it's a good idea to remind those who may not be aware of the significant advantages that will accrue were you to become a Patreon supporter, a word in your ear. What are those many advantages? Alex, over to you.
Well, first of all, you get the immense privilege of being able to join our weekly Friday night quiz.
Friday night quiz.
Yeah, unmissable.
Absolutely. It takes about 20 minutes.
It
starts every Friday evening at 6 o'clock.
An increasing top prizes offered.
Increasing number of people gather, possibly with a refreshing drink, surrounded by their loved ones, and attempt to answer impossible questions about popular music, but somebody does answer them. But anyway, so that's one thing, Friday night quiz. What else have we got, Alex?
You get access to a myriad of content before the rest of the world.
Absolutely.
Such as this very podcast.
This very podcast. And you also get it in vision.
In full vision, the full full multi-sensory experience.
Absolutely.
The classic podcast series.
Yes, old podcasts you have known and loved. Also, if you're in a certain tier, you get the rare privilege on your birthday of having me and Mark Ellen shin down your digital drain pipe to conduct a special word in your attic in your personal attic. Okay, and
show off your fabulous record collection.
Show off your fabulous record. Very good fun. And coming up soon, down the rabbit hole, a new series in which Mark Ellen and I follow our personal fascinations and our personal theories down the rabbit hole for your delectation and entertainment. You might find it interesting. You may not. But it's there.
We do.
So if you want to know more about how you can get involved in this, go to patreon.com, word in your ear.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.